When I was a kid growing up in Jersey, anybody who was a hoot or really funny or something, we'd call them a riot. Ladies and gents, this guy's a riot in more ways than one. Bob Dylan.
She was well rehearsed, fair, brown, and blonde. She had friends who were busboys and friends in the Pentagon, playing a show in Miami in the Theater of Divine Comedy. Talked the shadows where they talked in the rain. I could tell she was still feeling the pain. Pain of rejection, pain of infidelity. Was she a child or a woman? I can't say which. One to another, she could easily switch. Couples were dancing, and I lost track of the hours. He was well prepared. I know he was, paying attention like a rattlesnake does when he's hearing footsteps trampling over his flowers. And the Caribbean wind still blows from Nassau to Mexico, from the circle of ice to the furnace of desire. And the distant ships of liberty on them iron waves so bold and free, bringing everything that's near to me nearer to the fire. This is Pod Dylan, the show that celebrates the work of Bob Dylan one song at a time, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, The Freewheeling, Rob Kelly. And joining me this week, host of the Definitely Dylan radio show, Laura Tenchert. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I am a huge, huge fan of the Definitely Dylan show, and I'm really honored to have you on. This has just been fantastic. I'm so excited about it.
Me too.
Before we get to this amazing song, Caribbean Wind, and there are multiple versions, which we'll get into, and I chose to lead the show off with lyrics on my particular favorite version. There are many. There are many, many, many lyrics to this song. We have to talk about, like, how did you get to become a fan of Bob Dylan?
I think, unlike a lot of people who got into Bob Dylan through their parents, that wasn't really the case for me, because both my parents weren't really Dylan fans. My mom listened to almost exclusively classical music, and my dad listened to, you know, he likes Dylan, but is not really, really a huge fan. And I kind of discovered him just myself. And in part, it was because my music teacher asked me to sing in church, and he, That's what we were singing, because I grew up in the countryside in Switzerland and Germany. So he asked me to sing a Dylan song, and it was Every Grain of Sand.
Wow.
And I had, you know, I knew Blowing in the Wind. You know, I didn't know any Dylan, really. And I was 15 or 16, and he gave me this tape of Shot of Love. And I listened to it, and I was, you know, it just struck me. And I was completely, you know, I was gone. And you know, then I quickly had to, you know, buy the entire discography, as quickly as I could. And that was it for me, you know. And I had never felt as passionately. Actually, no, I was really into the Beatles when I was like 9 or 10. But with Dylan, it was just something else. And I've just been really passionate about his music ever since, really. Yeah.
I assume you've seen him in concert?
I've seen him. I think I've seen him, I kind of lost count, not that often, but I think I've seen him maybe 16 times. I mean, you know, it's nothing compared to some people who've seen him like hundreds of times.
Right, but right, right.
Yeah, no, I've cherished every single one of them.
When was the last time?
I saw him last April here in London at the Palladium.
Oh, wow. Okay. Good show?
It was great. I really think that the Sinatra stuff did wonders for his voice. I love the way he is now approaching songs, and I think it's also really impacted how he thinks his own material. I went on about it on Twitter. I don't know if you saw that. By the way, the Twitter handle is @DefDylan, in case
That's
anyone
right.
wants
yep.
to follow me. I listened to some of the recent shows, and especially the Brisbane show in Australia. It's so good. It's excellent. His singing is as good as, I don't know, as good as it's been this millennium. It's wonderful.
He really seemed to be enjoying those songs. I've noticed from the recent set lists, he's mostly gotten rid of them at this point. But for the last couple of shows, he really seemed. It was interesting to watch him just stand there and just sing. You know, he does keyboard, no guitar. It's just him standing there in his cowboy boots, just singing these old songs.
Yeah.
So how did the show come about? How did Definitely Dylan come about? Because again, I don't think there's anybody who's listening to this who doesn't listen to Definitely Dylan. But in case there is, I mean, it's Laura hosting the show, and it's kind of like Theme Time Radio Hour, except this show, Definitely Dylan, is all Bob centered around a particular theme. I mean, the last episode you did like the weather, which of course you mentioned Caribbean Wind on that episode. So
yeah.
It's that kind of thing of like taking a theme, and of course Dylan's catalog is so deep that you can do that, that you can, you know, pick a theme and have, you know, 15 songs about that particular theme. So how did the show come
about?
Exactly.
Well, it kind of came about because I was interested in the medium of radio, and I just had this idea that I wanted to do a radio show. And while I was thinking about it, it took me all of 2 minutes to realize what this radio show would obviously be about, because I just thought, you know, what is something that I know excessive amounts about, and you know, because I think all of my friends have heard me talk about Bob Dylan so much, and I don't have that many friends who are actually Dylan fans, so a lot of them have indulged me for a long time. and so that seemed like an obvious choice to do a radio show about Bob Dylan. But then also, you know, I think Dylan, and this is something that's really important to me, Dylan to me is still such a male-dominated field, you know. I think when most people think of Dylan fans, you know, they probably think that they're predominantly male. And I don't even think that's true, but for some reason, I think the discussion is mostly led by men, and a lot of them obviously very intelligent and very accomplished. But I've always missed the female voices in the discussion. And so it was really important for me to add my voice, literally in this case, because it's the radio, and to add a couple of perspectives that I just felt were missing when talking about Dylan. And you know, because I notice it often when I read books about Dylan, and I think, wow, you know, I would have absolutely not put it that way, or, you know, I think you're really missing, I don't know, had you asked a woman, she would have read that line totally differently or something. So I just thought it would be nice to do something that is, at least, you know, I'm not saying it wasn't there at all, because obviously there are women writing about Dylan and talking about Dylan, but I think it's still underrepresented, and so it was important for me.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, when I started this podcast, it was really born out of the notion that I just wanted to hear a Bob Dylan podcast. You know, I was like, I would like to listen to that. And I went on iTunes, and I'm like, there are no Bob Dylan podcasts. How can that be? There's 15 Kiss podcasts. What the hell?
What?
There's something like that, you know. There's like 12 podcasts about Scooby-Doo. I mean, no offense to Scooby-Doo, but I'm just like, how can there not? I mean, now, of course, in the field of the written word, there are reams of Bob Dylan books. I mean, you could read Bob Dylan books and read nothing else for the rest of your life, and you'll never run out of Dylan books. But I mean, outside of Dylan album by album, which just started recently, and then your show, like, there isn't that much, and that's just stunning to me. And so that was kind of the reason I started mine, was my little humble little effort. It was just like, look, I like talking about Bob Dylan. I can talk extensively about it, maybe not as intelligently as I hope to, but at the very least, I'm passionate about it and I love it. And so that's good enough for me. And so, that's what I get from your show. It's just like the Dylan fandom is one of those things where it's like, I don't want to hear somebody who just says everything is awesome, because that's boring. But at the same time, I don't want to hear from somebody who's got kind of an axe to grind either, because like, I love it, you love it, and that's what's pleasurable. I can hear when you do the show, I can hear the joy in your voice as you're talking about these songs.
Yeah, I think for me, it was predominantly just I wanted to make the kind of show that I would enjoy listening to.
Right.
And I think that's exactly what you're talking about as well. And for me, it was really important. I'm personally not interested in speculations about Bob Dylan's personal life.
Right.
I think that's not only secondary to me, it never helps to actually understand the songs. And you know, it never adds anything to the discussion, and I think it's often quite disrespectful as well. I just wanted to make a show that was filled with the enthusiasm that I have for Bob Dylan and his work, and that played songs that you also wouldn't necessarily hear on the radio. But, you know, at the same time, there are so many Dylan songs that I immediately put on a playlist for someone who isn't familiar with Dylan, because I think they're so accessible. Something like, I don't know, Mississippi. But, you know, you wouldn't necessarily hear that on the radio. So right, I wanted to make a radio show where I play all these great songs and talk about them as kind of, in my head, I wanted the show to be something that would be interesting both for people who are already big Dylan fans and also for people who might have been Dylan skeptics so far. But, you know, either because the work is just so vast and it's so hard to find a way in, or people who see Dylan as just someone who's done like a Rolling Stone or, you know, the times they're changing, and who was just never really interested in that particular aspect of his career. And so to offer a view of Dylan the artist as kind of wider and, I don't know, to take a little bite every week, and in that little bite-sized portion, make him accessible for lots of different people.
Yeah, I would say the show absolutely does that. Really gets at the depth and breadth of what's out there. And so,
thank you.
Yeah, it's just fantastic. So anyway, the song we're here to talk about, this is one of the great white whales of Dylan fandom, I would say. Caribbean Wind. It's a song that was recorded for the Shot of Love album you just mentioned. And Bob, this is one of these songs that Bob just kept hammering away at and never quite got it to the version that he wanted. And he eventually left it aside. And would you agree, Laura, that before the release of post the release of Blind Willie McTell on the bootleg series, this song is probably the greatest lost Dylan song? I mean, in terms of a song that just never surfaced again. I can't think of anything more impressive than this song that never made it out officially in any real way. I mean, it's on Biograph, but that was kind of just it didn't make it onto an album proper.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true, because I remember first hearing about this song because one of the early books on Dylan that I read was Paul Williams, Performing Artist. And I still think that his books are some of the best work written on Bob Dylan, and those are the ones that I recommend to people. And I skipped volume one and just read volume two. It's almost like the reverse Traveling Wilburys. And I read about a bunch of songs that sounded incredibly interesting, and I didn't have Biograph at the time. And so the two songs that I was most looking forward to were Abandoned Love, which is still to this day one of my favorites, and Caribbean Wind. But it was such a bittersweet thing when I finally got Biograph, because while I really loved that version, in the back of my head, I kept thinking that Paul Williams said that this is the vastly inferior version, and nothing is as good as the live version that he writes about. And I mean, It's really interesting, as I was actually thinking about this earlier. Paul Williams only writes about those two versions, and we now know two versions that Paul Williams wasn't familiar with, right? We know that other studio version from March 81, and then this beautiful rehearsal version with Pedal Steel, which was released on Trouble No More at the end of last year. I would absolutely say that maybe along with Girl from the Red River Shore, that was another song that was highly anticipated by people, because some musicians that were there for the Time Out of Mind sessions, they also said that that was one of the great lost masterpieces.
Yeah, it's up there. It's remarkable how much it is kind of amazing that of all the versions that they decided to finally put on Biograph, they did put the one that I would argue, now that we've had the chance to hear multiple, is by far the least. It's still a great song, but to me, the other two versions, the one you just mentioned, the Pedal Steel one, which was just released on Bootleg Series, and this other one, the one that I have as a bootleg, It leaves the Biograph version in the dust. It just does. It does lyrically. It does sonically. And so I'm always just amazed at the sort of the perversity of what do they choose to put this stuff out? So when did you finally get to hear a version of it?
Well, I mean, I heard the Biograph version fairly soon after I read that Paul Williams book because I wanted to get my hands on Biograph so I could finally hear a version. And then I got both the live version and the other studio version because I got the, I mean, at some point I downloaded the Genuine Bootleg series.
Right.
You know, when I had better internet and I found a corner of the internet where I could download them. And then I was, oh man, having those three versions to kind of compare and contrast and study and, you know, immerse yourself in, to me was, I was kind of obsessed with listening to those three versions back to back for a while. And so when it was announced that Trouble No More would have not only the live version in better quality, which is really nice, I think, but also another version from before the live version, right? This is September of 1980, the pedal steel version. So that's the earliest version. I thought that was such an interesting additional piece to the puzzle, you know? And we're still missing a lot of other versions.
Yeah.
He rehearsed that song so many times. And apparently the Biograph version also wasn't the last time that he recorded it in the studio. The next day they recorded another version. And I don't know, I hope that at some point they're going to put together the equivalent of the cutting edge for that time, you know, and that they're just going to give us everything.
Yeah. The version, the Biograph one, the reason that one to me doesn't work as well, partly again, I think the lyrics have been reworked and reworked and reworked are to me less effective. And also he's got like a backup singer on the Biograph version. And to me, this song is a song of solitude. To me, it doesn't work to hear another voice on the song. And so that's why I prefer the pedal steel one and the other one, the Clover Studios one, is because it's just him. And to me, it conveys that feeling of loneliness that to me is inherent in the song. So when I hear another person trying to harmonize with him, it just feels very wrong to me.
See, that's really interesting that you say this, because I personally really like the harmonies, especially on the chorus. I think they make the chorus soar like the other ones don't. And I mean, I also think that the Biograph version is the weakest version out of the bunch, I mean, by far. But I do think that the harmonies on the chorus really add something. But I mean, then again, I love Clydie King, and I'm assuming that that's her. She was singing with him a lot around that time. And I mean, I think it works better on the chorus than on the verses.
Yes.
Because you know, Dylan's phrasing is just so much his own, and it's always hard for anyone to kind of keep up with his phrasing. But I think on the chorus, I personally really like it, but I can certainly understand why you say for you it doesn't work.
I think it works. I just think it's just the other ones are, to me, it really gets under my skin. I mean, the first time I ever heard this song, I may not have even heard about it in a book form until I heard the song. And there was a record store in New York City that I used to shop at all the time, Generation Records, represent, and they sold lots of bootlegs. And they had a Dylan section, and I would just gobble up as much as I could get. I was more about getting the alternate songs and studio stuff than live versions. But nevertheless, I just, every time I was in the Village, I stopped in this record store and I bought two or three bootlegs at a time. And I didn't even really know what I was getting. You know, I would just look at the back and go, what's the, I never heard of any of these things. Let me buy this. So I got this thing and I got this version, which is very rough sounding. It's clearly not meant to anyone to hear it officially. It's got this, the you hear the guitar kind of tune as it comes in. The sound is not great, but it's the first time I heard it, it just hit me like a 2x4. I mean, I just was, oh my God, the lyrics of this thing. And again, this is with the version that's my favorite version. And I'm going to quote a little. I know, we're going to get to yours, I promise. We're going to. But the lyrics of the one that I'm talking about that I led off the show with, it continues on. He says, she looked into my soul through the clothes that I wore. She said, we got a mutual friend standing at the door. And you know, he's got our best interest in mind, which once again, this idea of the triad. Dylan loves these triads in songs. It's Tangled Up in Blue or Visions of Johanna. There's Brownsville Girl. There's always two people, and then there's a third person that kind of comes in and out. He was well connected, but her heart was a snare, and she had left him to die in there. He had two payments due and knew he was a little behind. Well, I slept in a hotel where flies buzzed my head. Ceiling fan was broken. There was heat in my bed. Street band playing, Nearer My God to Thee. We met in secret where we drank from a spring. She said, I know what you're thinking, but there ain't nothing we can do about it, so we might as well let it be. And then the verse that I think is in every version, because I think he knew how good it was, the Atlantic City 2 years, although this is, slightly modified. Atlantic City 2 years to the day, I hear a voice crying, Daddy, and I look that way, but it's only the silence in the Buttermilk Hills that call. Every new messenger bring in an evil report about rioting armies and time that is short, and earthquakes and train wrecks and hate was scribbled on the wall. Would I have married her? I don't know, I suppose. But she had bells in her braids and they hung to her toes. But I heard my name and destiny say to keep moving on. Then I felt it come over me, some kind of gloom. But I say, come on with me, girl, I got plenty of room. But I knew I'd be lying, and besides, she had already gone. And then he does the verse again. And all those so lines good. Just absolutely rocked me to my core. There's so much about it, but the line about would I have married her? I don't know, I suppose. The sort of shrugginess of that, this kind of like, I don't like, that's a huge thing. Would you have married her? I don't know, I suppose. Like, there was something about that just absolutely hit me so hard, and it still does. And there's to me, it's just, if you can forget about the rough sound of it, because the song doesn't really end properly. It kind of just kind of thumps end, because again, I think it's really more of a rehearsal. But you hear, I can't imagine being in the room, being a musician, and hearing these lines and going, oh my God, this. And then to hear Bob say, yeah, we're not going to use that one. My God, you know? Oh.
You know, I think the line that you just highlighted is actually a really key line when you think about it, because I read an interview where Dylan said that Caribbean Wind was a song about being someone for all the wrong reasons. And I think that is summed up in the line, would I have married her? I don't know, I suppose. You know, that's, why else would you marry someone and not be sure about it than if you're with someone for the wrong reasons? By the way, I mean, I remember this now. I first heard the Biograph version and then the live version, and I didn't know that this third version existed for years. And I remember that when I heard it, I had a really similar reaction to yours. This, I mean, apart from the fact that I didn't know it existed, and all of a sudden there's a third version of one of my favorite songs. and it's you know, it's crazy. And it's, I think it was also my favorite version. It's just that maybe it's because it's still kind of new to my heart, but I really love the version that was released on Trouble No More. But it's hard picking a favorite anyway, because I think there's something really compelling in the live version. There's something really compelling in that outtake that's your favorite, and the rehearsal version. And I even think there's something compelling in the Biograph version. It's just maybe the least compelling, but it's still, you know, it's still great.
Yeah, I mean, you talked earlier about, like, that, you know, if you're looking at these songs the right way, you're not trying to unlock his personal life, because that doesn't seem right. I mean, he wants to have his personal life be his personal life, and that's his business. And B, it also reduces the art a little, that it's all just biography. Well, it's not just biography. He's his art is no more just biography than a Picasso painting is, you know, it's a painting that exists for you to appreciate and understand, try to understand. It's not so much about what Picasso's life was like when he painted it.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you know, I can't help but think about how much the man tours, you know, how much that he's out on the road. And when that line about, you know, the Atlantic City. I hear a voice crying, "Daddy." I always think it's for me. I always feel like, does he? Well, obviously he does. Does he miss his kids? Is that the idea? Is that he's out there on the world, and he's away from his family. He's away from his children. I hear that line. There's always, I don't have children, but I that pang of missing a loved one to me hangs in that line of the, mm-hmm. the, you know, I hear voice crying, "Daddy." I always think it's for me. That's again, just the performance is so powerful and confident, and yet the lyrics betray someone who is fraying at the edges. And I think it's that tension that make it just so compelling to listen to.
It's also interesting because you could also read that line as daddy being something that, you know, a lover says to you, you know, true. Because yep. in the sense of like, "Daddy, you've been on my mind," as Joan Baez sings, "Mama, mm-hmm. you've been on my mind." And because I kind of always read that line as a kind of haunting memory of the person that he's left behind. Mm. And, two years to the day. And, or in the other versions, it's by the cruel sea. And the sea plays such a big role in the rest of the song, obviously, with the distant ships of liberty on them iron waves, so bold and free. And I don't know, it could also be that he hears a voice and it reminds him of that woman that he's left behind.
It's it's remarkable to think about this. Like, there's got to be this whole other universe of Bob Dylan's existence that have nothing to do with him being a performer. And I always wonder, like, when does he have time to do all this stuff? Like, when is he?
Yeah.
The man works a lot. He does a lot of concerts and he's recording. And when does he even have time to have a personal life? He obviously does, but it's sort of amazing, you know? It's like, wow.
To sail around the Caribbean, because that's where the song was written, right? Because around that time he had a sailboat,
right?
The Water Pearl, and he was sailing around the Caribbean and presumably wrote that song while he was off tour in the summer of 1980. And, you know, one thing that I was thinking is around that time, I think Dylan was really thinking a lot about changing and changes to his person and what it means to change as a person. And I think Caribbean Wind plays a role in that because, as I just said, he wrote that song during that summer. And when he came back, the next tour that he did was called the so-called Musical Retrospective Tour. And that I heard that this name was an attempt by the promoter to draw the crowds that had been scared off Dylan singing all the Christian material, which he had done exclusively the last year or so. But also, that tour was also when he started to introduce his old songs again and, in general, secular material, lots of covers. And also, around that time, Dylan gave an interview, and I just read it earlier, so I have it here in front of me. And he talked about what it's like performing old material. And he said, I'm going to read you this quote. He says, quote, "It's a very fine line you have to walk to stay in touch with something you've once you've created it. A lot of artists say, 'I can't sing those old songs anymore.' I can understand it because you're no longer the same person who wrote those songs. However, you really are still that person, someplace deep down. You don't really get that out of your system, so you can still sing them if you can get in touch with the person you were when you wrote the songs. I don't think I could sit down now and write 'It's All Right, Ma,' again. I wouldn't even know where to begin, but I can still sing it, and I'm glad I've written it." And this was coming at a time when Dylan was probably thinking quite a bit about how to reconcile his faith with, you know, everyday life once the honeymoon period of being born again had kind of worn off. And he was maybe wondering, you know, whether that intense period had changed him. And I think it's no coincidence that before the only live performance of Caribbean Wind on the 12th of November 1980, he prefaced it by with a little stage banter where he talked about Leadbelly. I'm sure you're familiar with this.
Yes, this bit about Leadbelly, yeah.
Yeah, and he says, and this I also have here, so I'm going to read this because I think it's fascinating. He says, "This is a 12-string guitar. First time I heard a 12-string guitar, it was played by Leadbelly. I don't know if you've heard of him. He made lots of records. At first, he was just doing prison songs and stuff like that. He'd been out of prison for some time when he decided to do children's songs. And people said, 'Oh, wow, has Leadbelly changed?' Some people like the older songs, some people like the newer ones, but he didn't change. He was the same man. And then immediately afterwards, he plays this song, Caribbean Wind. And I always thought, especially that line where he says, told her about Jesus, told her about the rain. And then the response from the woman, either she told me about the vision, told me about the pain, or she told me about the jungle where her brothers were slain. Or, you know, the different, various different versions. I think it's almost like he's struggling with who he actually is in the song Caribbean Wind. And that's also why, I mean, you were talking earlier about this triad of the woman, the singer, and then this third person. And I think it's not completely impossible that this third person, this man, is also almost like a doubling of the singer and kind of represents this other side, because you know, preaching resistance, waiting for the night to arrive, while on the other hand, the singer and the woman are touching, and the shadows are moving closer. And that's a thought that I had.
Yeah, I mean, I have to wonder about, he really did put it all on the line in 1979 and 1980 to go on a series. And of course, you know, I live with this stuff as just kind of something from his past, because I'm old enough to, I didn't live through that. I mean, I was alive, but yeah. I wasn't a Dylan fan when I was seven. So I didn't know about any of this stuff. So it's easier for me to accept it, because I just look at it as a phase of his career.
Yeah, because we knew that he, what he did afterwards, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. But I mean, at the time, for him to say, I'm no longer going to sing Blown in the Wind or Knocking on Heaven's Door or Tangled Up in Blue, and I'm just going to sing, you know, Slow Train Coming, that was, had to be really upsetting to people. And then conversely, for him to come out of that on kind of the other side of it, that had to be vulnerable to sort of have to admit that to your audience, to say, well, now I don't, you know, yeah, I know that I really, you know, went, I was about to say, use the phrase went crazy, and I don't mean that the way it sounded, but I really tripled down on it, but now not so much. That's inviting a lot of criticism potentially. And so you hear that in there, that it's, he's got this sort of constant inner reflection. And yeah, I mean, and the rap about Leadbelly does seem to suggest that he's trying to almost head it off before it gets started, of like, you know, okay, yeah, I was that guy that sang Slow Train Coming and sang, you know, Precious Angel, and I said certain things, and now I don't say exactly those same things, but I'm still the same man.
Yeah.
I feel like that's where he's headed with that. And
I just thought it's also interesting, because it's, as often with Dylan, it's such an ambiguous statement to make, because is he saying, I'm still the same guy that I was before I started singing these gospel songs? Or is he saying, through it all, I've been the same person, you know? Or is he saying, you know, is he trying to disavow certain things that he's done in the past? Or is he trying to, because that bit that he's saying in the interview is certainly suggesting that he thinks you're the same person through it all. And it's just a matter of tuning into a certain feeling that you are close to at a certain moment in time. And I think, I personally think that time in Dylan's career is so fascinating, not only because his performances, I think, are some of the best. That tour in 1980 is just stunning. I mean, including before, you know, in those Toronto shows from April 1980, and I think he was in many ways like at the height of his artistic capabilities as a performer.
I mean, he wrote an entire, he knew that when he hit the road that he couldn't just sing the songs from one record. So he wrote like an entire suite of songs to complement the Slow Train Coming songs, and then mixed in covers. And I agree, there is some absolutely amazing stuff. And I remember reading in a book, one of the books by Clinton Halen, I believe, where he said that right around 80 or 81, Dylan presented Columbia Records with a fully completed, sequenced, pressed, that's a vinyl thing, but a fully finished, produced, and sequenced live album of the gospel years.
Oh, yeah.
And they passed on it. They were like, no, thank you. Oh, come on!
I know. Well, it's the same with the TV special that they did. Well, I mean, it's circulating, obviously, and the Trouble No More film that went along with the bootleg series had some of those performances and performances from the other concert, the Toronto Massey Hall. But that this was a TV special that never got aired because presumably there were no takers. Ugh. And it's kind of shocking to look back and, you know, how misunderstood that was yet again, you know. Yeah. I mean, I think Dylan was a couple of times misunderstood throughout his career.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you consider that for decades, the only way you could get this material was as bootlegs, which sounded terrible and, you know, it had audience noise. And it really wasn't until the bootleg series just last year that they finally decided, hey, there's some archival, historical and financial value to this material.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm really interested to see what other things we're going to get in the bootleg series, because, you know, there's so many treasures there.
Oh, jeez. Now, the version that you say is your favorite, the pedal steel one, for just the easiest way to mention it. Now, that version, I will admit, when I first heard it, I was kind of like, okay. I like it, but I don't love it. But now that I've been listening to it more, ever since you told me that it was your favorite, I've been playing it over and over again. It's growing on me. And first of all, lyrically, it's very different, which, again, it's like I'm just so impressed by the guy that he can do that. He can create this clothesline and hang different lyrics on it, and every version seems to work. But it, I don't know, there's a kind of like easy listening type sound to it. I don't mean that as a pejorative, but it's just it's more mellow than the version that I like. The one that I have is much more, to me, very intense. This one is much more laid back. He seems more melancholy than I don't know, it works for me a lot. I mean, I have the lyrics for that version here, and I don't know whether these are the correct lyrics, because there is no official version of the Trouble No More version.
I transcribed it the other day because I'm a nerd like that. So I sat down and wrote them down.
Do you have
down.
It in front of you?
Yep.
All right, read them off. I was going to do it, but I want you to do it. Okay, X. I knew you did. Okay.
No, you please. You go ahead. You read it.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully I got this one right. And if there's some part of it that's wrong, you can let me know. So this is the other version, the one from the bootleg series. Is she was from Haiti, fair brown and intense. I don't think she ever known about innocence. I was playing a show in Miami in the theater of mystery. Told about Jesus, told about the rain, she told me about the vision, told me about the pain that had risen from the ashes and divided in her memory. Was she a virtuous woman? I really can't say. Something about her said, trust me anyway, as the days turned into minutes and the minutes turned back into hours. Could I have been used and played as a pawn? It certainly was possible as the gain I wore on, but victory was mine and I held it with the help of God's power. And the Caribbean winds still blow from Trinidad to Mexico, the circle of light, the furnace of desire, the distant ships of liberty on the myron waves so bold and free, bringing everything that's near to me nearer to the fire. And then in the next verse, he gets to one of my favorite lines, and I wish he had retained it for the other versions. The shadows grew closer, and they touched on the floor. Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. By the way, I think what you were just reading might be the live version.
Okay. All right. Right. Okay. Because he talks about Curacao, right? In the
Yeah. It was a slight mix between the two, because you did have the virtuous woman. But the version that I have is, was she a virtuous woman? I really can't say. Something about her said, trust me anyway, as the days turned to minutes and the minutes turned back into hours, which, by the way, is a line that I love. I think that is beautiful. And that, to me, is missing from the version that you really like. I pretended to be sleeping, and he thought I was, but I was only paying attention like a rattlesnake does when he's hearing footsteps trampling on the flowers. You know, I think what I really love about this version is, I mean, on the one hand, I as I said, I like it because it's still new to me. And it's a lot slower, as you said, and has a really different feel from the other versions, because the other ones are really kind of almost tempestuous, and this one's more like a light breeze. But I love his vocal performance in this. And I think this is the version that we have where I find his vocal performance the most consistent. Because I hope you don't take this the wrong way if I say this, but the version that you love, that bootleg studio outtake, I think it starts out so strong. It starts out with such a strong and wonderful vocal performance, but to me, it always sounds like he loses interest towards the end of the song. And the last few, especially the last few choruses, kind of sound a bit like he's just, you know, let's get this over with. And I just think it's a bit of a shame because it starts out so strong. I mean, in the beginning, I think that's the best beginning of A Caribbean Wind, of that version, if we're being like really, really nitpicky.
Right. No, I would agree with that. I think during the choruses, he does seem to kind of just to roll the words around in his mouth because he's kind of just getting to it. He's a furnace of desire. Like, he's just kind of like almost humming it. The version, the pedal steel one, he's much more, I would say, verbally, lyrically engaged from the beginning to the end. I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, but you know, I think that I've read in a couple of places, actually, that people said, you know, Caribbean Wind is as big a song in Dylan's work as songs like Mr. Tambourine Man, Visions of Johanna, Tangled Up in Blue, Idiot Wind. I mean, I completely agree with that. And I think they're all standout songs. And interestingly, Dylan also didn't get any of those right on the first attempt. He had to go back to all of them. You know, he recorded Mr. Tambourine Man for Another Side of Bob Dylan and then left it off and went back to it. And obviously, Visions of Johanna changed quite drastically. Tangled Up in Blue obviously got re-recorded for, you know, and the New York sessions got scrapped. And I think, unlike those three or four, he decided to leave Caribbean Wind after tons of attempts that he wasn't happy with. And I think the fact that he never quite got the song right actually, to me, adds to its allure. Because on the one hand, I mean, you know, first of all, like with all outtakes and bootlegs and so on, they're alluring already because we can kind of like catch a glimpse at Dylan's process, right, as an artist, as a performer, as a recording artist, and because we can see, you know, what songs sounded like before the version that is famous. So that's already alluring. But I think in the case of Caribbean Wind, I think the absence of the finished product to me is especially alluring. I'm going to say this word again. Because even though I think with Dylan, it's difficult to speak of kind of, you know, quote unquote, definitive versions anyway, because he keeps rearranging stuff and rewrites stuff. And, you know, when he performs them live. But nonetheless, I think with an album version like the one of Mr. Tambourine Man or Visions of Johanna, you know, Tangled Up in Blue, they're so iconic that you can call them definitive versions, even if it's just in that moment. And in those versions, I think we're allowed to see the song through the eyes of the artist as kind of a whole and finished product. And at least they stand for a moment in time in which Dylan decided that this is the version he wanted us to hear. And, you know, in that they kind of represent a song set in stone in a way. And basically, since Caribbean Wind never got to that stage, I think the song remains a mystery to us. And the song kind of has all the markers of one of Dylan's great songs. But what's missing is that final ingredient in the creation process, when, you know, the song would usually come together and the performance would come together and then is considered finished or whatever. So we're kind of left to speculate on what a definitive version would be like, because we've been given all these sketches on all these various building blocks. And I don't know about you, but when I was younger, I often thought about the song like a sort of puzzle, when I was thinking, you know, if I just take the right line from this version and the right line from this version, maybe I could somehow assemble the perfect version of the song. But that's obviously not how it works, because if anything, it left me more mystified, because we know these four different versions and they're all kind of great in their own way. But what we're wondering is what exactly is missing from the song that Dylan never considered it finished. And it's not because the lyrics aren't good, you know, or crafted well, because I think with all songs, the lyrics are really well crafted. But it's something else that's missing. It's this kind of like artistic, I don't know, can we call it like genius, that Dylan was struggling for and kind of apparently couldn't find. And I think it's not like when you see an unfinished wall, you know, and you see all the bricks and you can kind of like tell the outline of the finished wall and you think, oh, okay, you know, this is what would have, you know, come and this is then what the finished product would look like. I think it's more like, I don't know, this maybe sounds a bit pretentious, bear with me here, but I think it's almost more like a kind of alchemy or a kind of hermetic process where you take these ordinary elements, even though I wouldn't necessarily call the lyrics ordinary, you know, but like these ordinary elements that then get transformed into something greater than the sum of their parts. And I think with Caribbean Wind, we see all the elements and we can see how close it is to its finished, you know, golden state. But what we are left with and what we see most clearly is the absence of that finishing touch. And to me, that's what's absolutely fascinating and so wonderfully mysterious about the song.
I've been listening to Bob Dylan for 30 years now, I guess. Yeah, around 89 or 90. And even all the hours and minutes turned back into hours, I have thought about Bob Dylan. I have never really considered what you just said. And so I am humbled by your analysis there, because I think that is friggin' genius, Laura. Really do. I completely, as you were talking, I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what it is. Like a Rolling Stone, Tangled Up in Blue, all those other songs that you mentioned, they do have a quote-unquote definitive version, and then the rest can be compared to that. And you can say, well, I like that other version, but it does have the one that is presumably set in stone. And Caribbean Wind doesn't have that. And so it allows the listener to pick whatever version they like and say, this is the definitive one, because no one else has come in to make that judgment, you know, and so I never thought of it that way, but I think you're absolutely right. And I think that that's what makes part of the song so alluring. I'm using your word, alluring, because it has a version for everybody. I mean, there's so much stuff I want to respond to what you just said, and I'm trying to keep it all straight in my head before I lose it. Like, first of all, you're talking about the lyrics. I mean, this is almost something where he had too many good lyrics. You know,
he couldn't decide what story to tell.
Right. I mean, and it's sort of funny that he borrowed things for other songs. I mean, the line in this song about riding armies in time that is short in earthquakes and train wrecks and hate was scribbled on walls. He just transposed that and put it in The Groom Still Waiting at the Altar, because the same line about, you know, all this craziness going on. And so for that, obviously when he left Caribbean Wind behind, he decided, well, I can take this part and patch it into Groom Still Waiting at the Altar. And then the other thing that you mentioned about that he just couldn't obviously figure out what was missing. And, you know, Dylan famously has never really worked with producers. I mean, he has, but he really is the engine of any particular recording. And, of course, now in the last 15 years, he's not worked with any producer except for this mysterious Jack Frost figure. And but, I mean, no one has had the authority to say to Dylan, no, this is the version, or do this or do that. He doesn't. He is ultimately going to be the guy that decides it. And I think in the end, that's for the best. I mean, who else is going to be the best arbiter of what he wants to say than the man who's creating it? That said, I wonder if in this particular case, it would not have helped to have a Jerry Wexler or a Mark Knopfler in there. Daniel Lenoir, a 13-year-old Daniel Lenoir, to go up to him and say, Bob, look, this song, you got to finish it. You got to finish it. This one is too good to leave behind. And I almost wonder if in that specific case, it wouldn't have helped him to have somebody that he trusted. But at the same time, I hear what you're saying. I really think that it's like, I hear what you're saying about your I'm calling it your version now. I'm hearing your version and I hear my version, and I'm like, yeah, I completely agree with you that there are parts of your version that are superior to parts of my version, and yet there's parts of my version that I still like more than anything. So, but yeah, I'm just so humbled that you thought of it that way, because I think that's exactly right. That it is missing that one piece that makes this song so different than any other any other lost song that he's got out there.
And you know, it's also interesting because Paul Williams, who only knew the live version and the Biograph version, he said, I mean, he calls the live version the definitive version. And I've thought about this, and I thought it's probably easier if you only know two versions, and you like one so much more than you like the other one, to call the one the definitive version, right? But since we know four versions, and three of them are wonderful, and all of them are really great, you know, it gets so much harder to choose the best one. We can have a favorite one, you know, we can have our favorite one, but it's almost impossible to decide which one's the best one.
Yeah, and I would agree, actually. I would think that of all the versions that exist, I think it's the one on Trouble No More that would fit most effectively on Shot of Love. I mean, as much as I love, again, I'm using my, I'm putting, doing air quotes here, my version, it would stick like a sore thumb out on Shot of Love. I'm just sonically, but the version from Trouble No More, I'm like, this could have easily been put onto Shot of Love, and it would have fit, and it would have made that record even more impressive, you know? So it's, and the thought that there might even be other versions of it out there, because we know he kept working on me. He knew he really had something here, but he just couldn't get to it. And it's just so tragic, because it's the idea that all this genius is sort of hidden behind a door that none of us ever going to get to hear unless Sony decides to finally put these bootleg series out. I mean, and that, I will admit, that was part of the appeal when I first heard it, was hearing it as a bootleg. It just felt like it was this secret thing that only I and a few people knew about. And it was this crazy, you know, wow, Bob sending these messages out that didn't quite, this message didn't land the way other ones did, but boy, this is amazing. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's really startling. I mean, can I ask you, like, what do you, I don't want to pin it down for it means just this thing, but what does a song mean to you? Like, how do you take it as, not what does it mean, but what does it mean to you?
I mean, to me, it speaks of, I mean, this sounds like such a broad statement, but there's obviously a lot of inner turmoil in the song of someone. I mean, Dylan says it's about being with someone for all the wrong reasons, but it also sounds to me like meeting someone at the wrong time, you know, when that person doesn't fit into one's life, because of where the singer is at that particular moment in time. And it's that, I mean, that is what the song kind of evokes for me. And by the way, because you were saying earlier that one of the lines almost found a new home in the groom still waiting at the altar. Have you noticed that both the Furnace of Desire and the distant ships sailing into the mist, you were born with a snake in both of your fists while the hurricane was blowing.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're right. There's the distant ship show up again. Yeah.
And you look into the fiery furnace, see the rich man without any name. It's so it almost seems to me like that song also got revisited for a bit of Joker Man. I don't know. I don't know what that means. I think the song here, Caribbean Wind, is full of kind of Bible references, and I'm sure I'm not picking up all of them because, surprise, I don't know the Bible by heart.
Ditto.
But one thing that I'd like to ask you is, how much do you think do the variations in the lyrics change what the song is about for you?
That's a quick question. I feel as though he he has done this a couple of times where I think he has reworked certain songs to where the later versions I think are less personal. And I think that's him.
Oh, yeah.
That is him trying to – maybe he's uncomfortable. I mean, you know, maybe the first version that he jots down is the one that's ripped right out of his heart or his head or his soul. And he jots it down and he records it. And then he goes back and he listens and he goes, okay. Maybe, you know, I'm not as comfortable with that as this or that. It reminds me a little bit about I think Clinton Halen again has talked about – Covenant Woman, where he says, you know, the version on Saved is a pale imitation of the live versions, and he says maybe that's because the woman that he wrote it for, when he wrote it, he was in a relationship with her, and by the time he got to record it for Saved, he wasn't in that relationship anymore, and it just couldn't help but color the passion that he had for the song. Now again, that's Clinton Halen's supposition. I don't really know.
So are the lyrics different to Covenant Woman from the live version to the album version, or is he talking about the performance?
I think he's talking about the performance. He's talking about the performance.
Oh, okay.
Because I mean, I love the version of Saved, and like we're talking about,
me
that's
too.
The official version. But I can understand what he's saying, and so yeah, I think it's basically the same song across the versions. It's just, I think it's less intense. It's a little, it's just more vague. The one on Biograph is just a little more vague than the other versions. I mean, like I said, I mean, I asked you about what it means to me, what it means to you. And like, I will admit, and I mentioned this on the episode I did on In the Summertime, where, you know, I know that song is not about what I think it's about. But I know what it's about to me because I know what was in my life when I heard it. And I will admit that when I heard this song for the first time, you know, I was coming out of a relationship where if you had asked me at the time point blank, would you have married this woman? I would have said yes, and it would have been a catastrophically bad decision. But in the moment, I would have said yes. And so there's something, again, about that line about the, you know, would you have married her? I don't know, I suppose. That's to me, the whole song pivots around that line because that's the one that just where I'm like, wow, Bob's talking to me.
Yeah.
I don't know how he's doing it, but he is. And so I feel like each version has that same intensity. It's just, it fades a little in Biograph. It picks up more in the pedal steel version. To me, it reaches its zenith in the other version. And then differently in the live version. And again, I'd love to know what other versions are out there, but yeah, I would say he's getting at the same thing every time, but just not as effectively on the one that they finally put on Biograph.
Yeah, I think there's certain, I mean, you've already said this, there are certain lines that are pretty consistent or that appear in most versions. And then there are certain lines that he obviously kept changing and that he kept playing with. And I think one that I think it's maybe telling is the one that in the pedal steel version, he says, was she a virtuous woman? I really can't say. Something about her said, trust me anyway. And I think if we do assume that this could potentially be sung by someone who is struggling to not stray from the path of righteousness and who meets this woman and he's not quite sure what his potential relation to her could be. And whether or not she's a virtuous woman is, on the one hand, important for, you know, his own self-conception as a man of faith, you know. But something about it is, trust me anyway. So it's this kind of potentially, you know, going against your better instincts. And in the other version, you know, was she a child or a woman? I really can't say. Something about her said, trust me anyway. And was she a child or a woman? I can't say which. From one to another, she could easily switch. And then was she a child or an angel? Did we go too far? In the Biograph version, which is so clearly the most contrived version to me. Mm-hmm, was she a child or an angel? I think what you're saying about potentially making lyrics less personal, I think this must be something that Dylan or any artist is struggling with to a point, because in the end, the artistic process means taking an inspiration, which can be taken from real life, obviously, and then transfiguring it into fictionalizing it or however transforming it into a work of art. And I can understand how, for several reasons, Dylan might be trying to get away from the very personal first instinct. Because on the one hand, obviously, because he is very famous and people constantly try to read into his songs and try to use the songs to get closer to the person, Bob Dylan, which must be a really terrible thing, must be something really difficult to deal with. But also on the other hand, that you probably think, is this really the best way of saying it, or is this just the first idea that I had? You know? Yep. And then once you start thinking about it, it's probably a slippery slope as well. But I mean, I'm generally interested in seeing early versions of Dylan songs. And just earlier, I listened to a recent episode on Joker Man, and I know you talked about that too. Hearing early versions of Dylan songs, I actually did a whole episode on rough drafts and early versions on Definitely Dylan, in case anyone wants to check it out. And I think that Caribbean Wind is basically four different early versions without a final one. Makes it just infinitely interesting.
Yeah, he's playing a show in Miami in every one of them. I think he clearly liked that line because
And apparently, I mean, Paul Williams makes a suggestion that this might indeed be the last show of the 1978 tour because he ended in Hollywood, Florida, which I think is pretty close to Miami.
Interesting.
Is it? I don't know.
I think so. Yeah, I believe it is.
It's in the same state for sure.
It's absolutely the same. Florida's pretty big, but I do believe it's actually pretty close. Yeah, it's like I said, it's a song that just to me it gets like a lot of his best songs. It gets deeper the more you listen to it. It doesn't wear out its welcome. There are other songs of his that I like a lot that I'm like, okay, what I got out of it the first time is what I get out of it now, but no more. But this is not one of those songs. This is something where, as I age, there's parts of it that I appreciate more now at the age I am than I did when I first heard it when I was in my 30s.
Yeah, me
and
too.
I heard that, you know, and I'm like, okay. And just again, the willingness to reveal insecurity contrasted with it being performed by someone who sounds like they are in full command of their powers is an amazing tension to me. I mean, this is somebody who completely knows what he's doing. But then, obviously, he's revealing something very vulnerable, and he's also totally not secure what he's doing because he hears what he just finished and decides to leave it, let it go, you know, to not put it on the album. He's like, no, let's put Lenny Bruce on instead. Okay,
sure,
Bob. All right.
Why not?
Yeah, I mean, I will say one of the things I love that on the bootleg series that they do occasionally is when they have an outtake. They leave in some bit of audio of Bob just talking in the studio.
Yeah.
I love hearing that of him saying, well, we could try it in D. Like the way he's just kind of just bashing around. It's fascinating to get to hear him in that sort of unguarded moment. I mean, he knows he's being recorded, obviously, but that stuff is also not meant for public consumption. And I find it fascinating just to hear him just say one or two lines about, well, we could try this. You know, it's so interesting.
I completely agree. And this is also, by the way, one of my favorite recordings probably ever. The version of Can't Wait on Telltale Signs where he says, if we do it, and how about B flat? And then starts playing and the musicians all kind of come in. To me, that was always such a magical moment, you know, him changing the key and starting to play. And I was really angry with my partner when he said, they edited that. That wasn't like that. And I was like, how can you say this? He would never. But the reality is, I mean, I do actually think it's, and this is also something that I've talked about on my show a couple of times, the bootleg series, and I think we should be aware of that, is obviously also a way of the Dylan camp to rewrite, reconstruct the official narrative.
Sure.
And I think it's not completely it's not completely impossible that they might sometimes, you know, do a little edit here and a little tweak there. And in addition to cleaning up the tapes, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to I don't want to, assume too much. But I think I'm only telling myself that so that I'm not disappointed when that comes out at some point, because, you know, I'm just steeling myself for the inevitable disillusionment. I don't know.
I can appreciate that. I mean, just as we're wrapping up here, I'll throw this in just because we're on this subject. Have you heard, I assume you have, but I want to ask you, have you heard the bootlegs for the MTV Unplugged show? I assume you have, right?
I have, yeah.
Because, of course, the version that he does of Like a Rolling Stone, which is very slow in the beginning, he perseveres with that for like a good 3 minutes before he finally says, okay, wait a minute, let's stop it. He's like, the band was way ahead of me on this one. But on the official MTV Unplugged album, it sounds like he only did it for like 30 seconds before he changed his mind. But in the bootleg version, he goes on and on with it. And he realized, like, I think almost the band is like, I don't think this is the right, I don't think we're doing this right. And he just keeps going. So in that case, they did edit it to make it sound like that the mistake was brief as opposed to the many minutes that he kept
going. Yeah, makes a more compelling TV, I guess.
Absolutely. It's MTV, you know. It's what do you expect from MTV? So, I mean, look, everybody here that's listening, this is the longest episode we've done of Pod Dylan to date. I could talk to Laura for the rest of the afternoon just about this song. Let alone anything else, but I think we should probably wrap it up here. It is an amazing song. I wish I could point everybody to an official release of the version that I love, but I can't do that, and I'm not gonna go send that people out looking for bootlegs because I don't want to do that. I would never do that.
On YouTube.
But it is on YouTube. There you go. There was a clip of it. There will be a clip of it at the end of this show. And there are alternate versions. There's the Biograph version, which you can get on iTunes. And there is the Pedestal version, which you can get on iTunes. And there is the live version, which you can get on iTunes. So all those versions are available. Laura and I heartily recommend them because I don't really believe that you can have a full picture of Dylan's work as a studio musician without hearing Caribbean Wind. I feel like we
haven't talked about the live version at all.
Well, before we then wrap up, then let's talk about the live version. Let's get into that one a little bit. What do you think about the live version that Paul Williams obviously found so amazing?
I really like the live version, and I think it's often the one that I think about the least. But whenever I hear it, it's such a strong performance, and it's really it's kind of electrifying, I think. And I actually think if you look at the lyrics, I mean, obviously there are a couple of lines where he seems to forget the lyrics, or he kind of mumbles, and you don't really know what he's saying, but sometimes I think that possibly the live version has the most coherent lyrics. I don't know.
I could see that. I can only imagine. I have never been at a Dylan concert. I've seen Bob 23 times. I have never been at a show where he has ever sang an original song of his that I was not familiar with. I've heard him sing covers that I didn't know the lyrics to. You played on your show when he did the Times We've Known by Charles Aznavour. I was at one of the shows that he sang.
Really?
That. Yeah.
Cool.
Madison Square Garden. I was like, whoa, what is this? But I'd have to go back and look at my records because, of course, I keep records of all this stuff. I would have to go back and look and see, did he ever debut a song that I was unfamiliar with? I don't think so. And I'm trying to imagine what it would be like to be in the audience and hearing a brand new song and trying to just decipher literally what he's saying. I mean, just this song is so lyrically dense. And then hearing it on top of the din of a live performance, I imagine it must have been just overwhelming. Like, what did I just hear? I don't even know what I heard. It's hard enough following him. When he's singing a song, you do know, let alone all new words. So, and I do wonder, it is a great performance, and I wonder why he didn't continue on with it. As you mentioned, he did it one time live, and that was it, never again. So I wonder, was he disappointed with the song? Was he disappointed with the performance?
It sounds like it. I think after he plays it in one of the recordings, I'm not sure if that's on the Trouble No More version, because I obviously have like three different bootleg versions in like different cleanups done by fans and so on, you know, that were made way before Trouble No More was released. And some of them have both a stage banter at the beginning, and then also at the end where he basically says, "Ah, you know, that wasn't very good. You know, we didn't quite get it or something." And it's really strange hearing that come from Dylan after this. You know, it's a tour de force. I think it's a really, really strong performance, and obviously of a song. But I think this is telling as well. It shows how much this was a song that Dylan was really, really working to get right.
Yep.
That this version still wasn't good enough, because they had been rehearsing it over and over in the weeks leading up to the tour. And it's funny, like, why were they rehearsing it so often if they weren't even... Apparently, he only played it because Paul Williams requested it.
Wow.
Imagine being the person who Dylan played the only live performance of Caribbean Wind for.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. So, obviously, then Paul Williams would say that the live version was the definitive version, right?
That's my version, sure.
Yeah, I would say that too if you sang it just for me.
Yeah. Oh my lord. Oh geez. Yeah. I'm the one, and I know this is not going to happen. So I'm just saying it for the sake of it. You know, Dylan rejected Blind Willie McTell and left it behind for 10 solid years before it was finally dug up for the Bootleg series, and then people were like, "Oh my god, this is amazing!" And now you can do it. Well, of course, he has worked it back into his concerts. I mean, he has sort of accepted that, oh, yeah, this was actually really pretty good. Maybe he even looks back at himself in the 1983 Bob and he's like, what was I thinking? This is great. Why did I do this? And so, you know, he's worked it in. I mean, he sang it as a tribute to Martin Scorsese a couple of years ago on a live television show. And my dream is, like, maybe someday we'll get another version of Caribbean Wind, and Bob will finally say, you know what, I can try this out on the road. Why not? Maybe we'll give this a
wouldn't
shot.
That be cool?
Yeah. I mean,
that
again,
would be interesting. I would love that.
Yeah.
There are a couple of songs. If you could choose three songs that Dylan didn't really either never perform live or left as outtakes and that he could bring back now with his voice now and with his band now, which three songs would you pick?
Oh my lord! Oh, you put me on the spot here. Well, obviously,
I don't know the answer either. But
okay, I'll talk slow so you can think of something. obviously, this song. Probably the original version of God Knows, which he did with Lanois, which has completely different lyrics, and I completely love. I would love to. I have to do an episode on that. That's one of those songs where I'm like, I don't want to ignore the finished version because there is a finished version that appeared on Another Red Sky. But the Oh Mercy one I love so completely that I want to do a whole show on that one. So maybe that version. And oh boy. I'm blanking on a third. I'm sure as soon as I'm done recording.
Oh, don't worry. It was a really mean question.
Oh, I know it now. Up to me. I would want him to do Up to Me. Yeah, there you go. He's never going to do that, but I would love to hear that.
Yeah.
Come on. You started this. Come on.
Well, I mean, Caribbean Wind would obviously be super interesting. Sure. To me, you know, I said this earlier, Abandoned Love to me is...
Oh, it's a great song.
Such a wonderful song, and that never quite got its due. Maybe Lay Down Your Weary Tune.
Oh, that's a beautiful song. Yeah, that would be fantastic. Another masterpiece that he was like, yeah, nah, leave this off.
Yeah, I'm going to say either or, because I also actually think Seven Curses is also such a great song. Such a wonderfully well-written song. I think those. And then just for the hell of it, because, I mean, he has played that song live, but I wish he would do Heart of Mine again.
That's a beautiful song, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, those are mine.
He does entire concerts now where he leaves out all of the 80s practically and like one song from the 70s. It's just sort of amazing. He does 60s and then he does all the modern albums and that's it. I'm glad that he's sprinkling some other stuff in. So, again, like, Laura and I, I'm sure, could go on and on and on because that's who we are. We're both nerds for this subject. So I'd say there's even more to say about Caribbean Wind, but I think we'll stop here. Laura, this was just I will say, no joke. I am really honored that you would do my show because this is just me, knucklehead, babbling into a microphone about a subject I know probably not that much about compared to other more scholarly people. And so I've been fortunate to have some amazing guests and things like that. And so the minute I heard your show, I was like, I would love to have Laura on my show. And it took me a while to screw up the courage to ask you.
Because
there are people who have said no. And I just like, oh, you know, you feel like Charlie Brown. But
Nah, it's been my pleasure.
Well, this was just terrific. I love your show. Tell people where they can find it.
Okay, so hopefully by the time this episode goes out, you can find the show at definitelydylan.com. It's not live as we speak now, but it will hopefully be up by the time we speak. And then the show is on Facebook at Definitely Dylan. If you just search for it, you can find it. Then I'm on Twitter and on Instagram, both at Def Dylan, DefDylan. And also you can find all the episodes on Mixcloud, mixcloud.com/definitelydylan. But you will also be able to find all episodes, including some show notes and some additional links on the website, definitelydylan.com, which is looking amazing, and I'm very proud to have it go live very soon. And also, the show is coming back from summer break on the 16th of September. That's tomorrow. We're not saying when this is recorded.
Well, actually, that'll be before people hear this episode, because this is the. So you'll be beating the show to the punch, which is great. People will be out there. It'll be back already.
So by the time you hear this, there will already be a new episode, so you can check it out, and I hope you'll join me over there.
Absolutely. I can't wait. That's going to be great. And I signed up for the newsletter. I'm good to go.
Cool. There's a newsletter as well. There's a newsletter as well, and you can sign up for it on the website.
Perfect. Perfect. So, of course, everybody, if you want to listen to back episodes of this show, it's all on iTunes and it's on all the various platforms and on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're always talking about Dylan over on Twitter, which is at pod_Dylan. So, Laura, I just wanted to say once again, thank you so much for doing this. This was an absolute pleasure. I mean, this is most of the shows on the Fire and Water site are about comic books, and that's a subject that I can nerd out about. But Dylan is like one of these other fandoms that I have that I almost don't want to talk about it with random people, because then I give them way more information than they want. You know, they'll ask me a little bit here and there, and then I'm like, da-da-da-da-da, and it's just, I see that stunned look in their eyes, because they're like, oh, I didn't know I had a geyser here. So it's so much fun to be able to talk to somebody that knows this stuff chapter and verse. I do. So this was just an utter delight, and I can't wait to have you back on the show, and I can't wait for Definitely Dylan to come back. I love talking to you.
Cool. Thanks so much, Rob.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and until the next episode, take it easy. Bye. Some Haiti, they're brown and intense. A bit of it, the home of the lost boys. Playing a show in Miami, in the theater of divine comedy. I told about Jesus, told about the rain. She told me about the vision, told me about the pain that had risen from the essence and abided in a memory. To see a child or woman, I really can't say. Trust me anyway, as these 10 minutes
shadows drew closer till they touched on the floor. Prodigal son's waiting close to the door. Pitching obscenities, waiting for the night to arrive. He was well connected, but her heart was a snare. She had left him to die in there. But I knew I couldn't get him out while he still was alive. Now the stars on the balcony, flies buzz my head. Ceiling fans broken as heat in my bed. Street band playing nearer my God to thee. She looked into my eyes. I hear the mission bells ring. She said, I know what you're thinking, but there ain't a thing you can do about it, so you might as well let it be. The Caribbean wind still blows from Mexico down to Curacao, from Chinatown to the furnace of desire. And them distant ships of liberty on them iron waves so bold and free, bringing everything and everyone close me, closer to the fire. Atlantic City, 2 years to the day. I hear a voice crying, Daddy, and I look that way. But it's only the silence and the buttermilk hills that call. Every new messenger bring an evil report about a rioting armies and time that is short. And earthquakes and train wrecks and heat waves scribbled on wall. Would I have married her? I don't know, I suppose. She had bells and braids and they hung to her toes. But I heard my name and destiny say to be moving on. Then I felt it come over me, some kind of gloom. Gonna say, come on with me, girl, I got plenty of room. But I knew I'd be lying, and besides, she had already gone. And then there will be a wind still blow from Nassau to Mexico. Her girl of eyes to the furnace I desire. And I've been in ships of liberty on the fire.